We'll need to start on time for these classes because there's kind of a lot of material. And I'm going to need all 2 hours in all four classes, but I won't go more than 2 hours if you're here on time. But I will start on time anyway. It doesn't matter. You're here on time, actually. Welcome to this set of teachings on the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, one of the great classics of world spiritual literature. Last night we talked about a great classic from the Hindu tradition, as it's categorized now. Of course, originally Bhagavad Gita wasn't a Hindu text, and originally most of these Buddhist texts were Buddhist texts. Did you know that? Hinduism and Buddhism are recent inventions as like overarching, you know, kind of labels for a whole bunch of different kinds of traditions, actually. And guess where they came from? Guess where those labels came from? From the outside. The English mostly invented Hinduism and Buddhism as labels. Did you know that? Yeah, because they went to Asia and they started looking around going, oh, y'all look the same to us. Y'all must be Hindu. And then we went to other places, oh, y'all look like you're Buddhists, you know? And then the labels stick, you see? Things exist nominally. And that's no joke. Words have power. But originally, these are not, isms, actually. They're lineages. They're different, streams of teaching, you know? That then got all lumped together into this isms thing. So last night we were talking about the Bhagavad Gita, a great classic of what we now call the Hindu tradition, and today we'll talk about the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which is a great classic from the Mahayana Buddhist tradition. These classes over the weekend are comprise a new course that as part of a new curriculum that I'm developing for the Middle Way centers, including this one. I sort of have in mind to get through 20 or 25 such courses if I live long enough. So this one, I'm thinking nowadays that also, you know, it's kind of in the early stages, the curriculum in its early stages of development, and I'm thinking maybe instead of calling them courses, to call them workshops. Because the main thing, of course, it's important to get through the material intellectually and to, you know, to get the transmission of a teaching and stuff like that. But if you don't put it into practice, it doesn't do any good at all. In one ear, out the other. You see, it doesn't change you. So each one of these classes has an exercise. No homeworks, no quizzes, okay? No worries about that, okay? Then relax about homeworks and quizzes and getting, like, yeah, getting 90. Oh, I only got 90 on my homework instead of 100. Yeah, never mind about all that. Learn the material, that's important. But more important even is to actually practice it, you see? So as you'll see, at the end of each class, I'll go through an assigned exercise with you. And actually, although we'll be doing this course over the 2 days, the real course will stretch over at least a week. If you do the exercises, you see. If you take the exercises home and practice it. So some of them require a week's worth of work. So hopefully you'll do that. I can't follow you all around and like see if you're doing the exercises. You know, no interest in doing that, actually. I think I could get arrested, probably. But... you know, if it's going to do you any good, you've got to try to put it into practice, you see? Just sitting here for 2 hours or for 8 hours, if you come to all four classes, and just listening to somebody blah, 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 isn't going to change you, you see? You've got to, it's up to you, it's up to every one of us, you know, to change ourselves. And so try, okay? Try to do the exercises, I beg you. Otherwise, you know, it's kind of just another 8 hours, you know, that we all kind of like, you know, spent together, it's nice and all like that, but didn't really do much. Didn't really change much. I've been teaching now for many years, and I've seen this over and over and over again. You know, people just don't do it, you know? And nobody can make you, but it's a shame. It's a waste of your time and a waste of my time if you don't actually try to put it into practice, you see? It's just kind of in one ear, out the other, like I said. This is, you know, as I said, the curriculum, you know, the formulation of the curriculum is in its very early stages. I had originally conceptualized this course as what I would classify intermediate, not a beginning level. I've already taught one of the beginning level courses on the four worthy truths. But this one's a little more dense. So you know, bear with me. You know, and I'll bear with me too. It's going to take a lot of work to get through this course. I think we have to get through something like 300 verses. Through 400 maybe. Yeah. And I'll see how it goes. I already know one section that I'm just going to kind of skip through. But I'm going to give it a go to you know, at least say something about pretty much every one of the verses that we'll cover over these four classes. And this is the first of a three-part series that I envision that will get us through the entirety of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. So in this course, we'll do the first five chapters. And then in a subsequent course, we'll do chapters 6, 7, and 8 together. And then the capper will be chapter 9, which is a great exposition on what's called emptiness. And then 10 is kind of just, you know, beautiful, nice poetry. So that's the intention, you know. And so here we go, okay? I promised myself, and I actually made the promise to other people, to not get too diverted, which is kind of my tendency, is to just talk about what comes into my head sometimes. So we got to kind of grind here a little bit and concentrate on the work at hand, okay? I'll give you a quick overview of the... Of the five chapters that we'll cover here in over the course of these four classes this weekend. The first, all of them concern what's called bodhicitta. Say bodhicitta. Yeah, bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is bodhi means awakening. It actually does not mean enlightened or enlightenment. That's kind of a mistranslation of the actual Sanskrit. It means awakening. And citta is a very interesting term, and kind of a technical term in Sanskrit. You know, sometimes it's just translated kind of, not incorrectly, but a little, maybe like sort of superficially, as mind. The mind of awakening. But what it really means is a mindset. You know the difference between a mind and a mindset? A mindset is an intention. In fact, you could say bodhicitta is the intention behind all intentions. It is the intention that should fuel all of our intentions, if you see what I mean. And so the mindset of awakening. So I'll just say a few things about what awakening, what you're awakening to, you know? Bodhi. Buddha and Bodhi come from the same root. So a Buddha is an awakened one. Awakened to what? Well, awakened, first of all, to reality. To reality, not to a dream. You don't awaken into another dream. We're already in a dream. Maya, the great illusion. We are deceived almost all, I would say always, pretty much always, by appearances. We don't see things the way they are. So a Buddha is awakened. Has awakened to truth, to reality. In Sanskrit, satya stands in for both those terms, truth and reality. So truth is what matches reality, you see, right? So awakening to reality. And one of the aspects of reality that you wake up to, the aspect, I would say, of reality that you wake up to is the fact of interdependence. That nothing exists independently. Everything exists interdependently. So I talked about this a little bit last night. Who wasn't here last night? Yeah. So here's a quick down and dirty thing on interdependence. There is no seer without an object visible, the visible object. These things exist interdependently. A seer isn't a seer until and unless they see something. Is that right? Can you be a seer and just say, I'm a seer, I don't see nothing, but I'm a seer? And the visible object depends on it being seen to be a visible object. Right? It's not a visible object until and unless it's seen by somebody. Did I just say that? Okay. And then the other shoe falls. And there's... both shoes have fallen. No seer without a visible object. No visible object without a seer. No teacher without a student. No student without a teacher. No father without children. No children without a mother or father. See? And all of life is like that. Everything in reality exists that way. And does not exist in any other way than that. And that is its emptiness. Okay? So how long did that take me to say? 1 or 2 minutes. That's the entirety of truth, of reality, of the teaching on reality. And then we spend our rest of our lives, you know, trying to realize that, you see, not just say it. You know, if you get good and you've said it enough like I have, you know, you can do it in 1 or 2 minutes. You can describe reality as it truly is in about 1 or 2 minutes. But then realizing that truth is a whole different ball of wax, right? So you awaken to the, not just to the intellectual, you know, kind of understanding, not just to the verbiage, but to the reality, to how things really are. You realize it. It's a very good verb, you know. You realize it or actualize it, you know, make it real. So you awake up to the fact of interdependence and emptiness. Interdependence means things exist interdependently. Emptiness means, and they don't exist in any other way than that. Or you could say things don't exist independently. No seer without a visible object. No visible object without somebody seeing it. And that's the case with all the senses and the mental sense too. There is no thinker without a thought thunk. You see? No thinker going, you know, I'm a thinker, I'm not thinking anything, but I'm a thinker. Soon I might think something, but I'm, see? No independent thinker. Right? And no independent thought that's just, you know, sort of floating around out there without somebody thinking it. It works at every level, you know. So for the Buddha heads in the room, this is what's called the emptiness of the three spheres. No independent thinker, no independent thought, and no independent thinking that links the thought and the thinker. See, these things are all dependent on each other, interdependent. So you wake up to that. And then you wake up to the implications. This is bodhicitta, right? You wake up to the implications of interdependence. And those are profound. And that leads you straight into the realm of compassion. Compassion, love, a feeling of harmony, of connection to other people and other things in your world, you see? And the breakdown of the feeling of isolation, of independence. You see, we all feel like, well, I'm independent. And in fact, we not only feel that way, but we valorize it. We give it value. Nowadays, you should be independent, or you should be an individual. It's so important to be an individual. Being an individual is our suffering. Feeling like an individual, separated out from other people, is a way of talking about our suffering, our dukkha. You see, so when the interdependence like sinks in enough, the truth of interdependence sinks in enough. We realize that none of us are independent. We've never been independent, you see? We've never been an individual. I am because you are. I am because you are. See, I would be nothing if there weren't for you, you see? In the relationships that we have. We exist in relationship at every level, with other people, with the world around us, everything. Is in relationship. Nothing exists independently. And the ramifications of that then generate this kind of compassion, this kind of love, this kind of feeling of connectedness with all life, with all existence, you see. That's bodhicitta, okay? That's what you wake up to. So it's, you know, they make a distinction between someone who has bodhicitta, who has really suffused their mind with that intention, with that understanding, and a Buddha who is fully awakened. Someone who has bodhicitta is technically called a bodhisattva, a being of awakening, literally. Somebody who is, you know, on their way to a... But you could say they've already awakened to something, right? They've already awakened to, you know, certain, like, very important things. But, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, they make a distinction between a bodhisattva and a fully enlightened, fully awakened being of Buddha. Now that's a kind of a Buddhist understanding of bodhicitta, right? And this is of course a Buddhist text, so it's kind of important to have a Buddhist understanding of it. But I would like all of these courses from the Middle West Center to be applicable not just to Buddhists, not just to self-designated Buddhists, self-identified Buddhists, but to any genuine spiritual seeker, regardless of their label, regardless of their name card, identity card, or the lack thereof. You see, you don't have to be labeled as anything, Christian, Buddhist, Jew, whatever. You don't have to be labeled as anything to be a spiritual seeker. And many, many people nowadays, increasingly, in places like this, in the U.S., increasingly don't want to be identified with any one tradition. And that's fine. There's kind of good reasons for doing that. There's a rationale for not, limiting yourself to one or another ism, you see, that have mostly been created recently, you see. In some cases, they've been going on for a while, Christianity and, Judaism have developed over a long period of time an orthodoxy. But some of them are rather new. Some of the, Taoism, for example, is another example of a very, very multivaried, set of traditions that just all got labeled. This all happened, by the way, in the late 18th century into the early 19th century. You see? So the idea that we have to affiliate with an ism is rather new, especially when dealing with the Eastern traditions. And no need to. If you don't feel comfortable, calling yourself a Buddhist, then just call yourself a spiritual seeker. But you can learn how to be a spiritual seeker, how to find what you're seeking, by looking at Buddhist texts, by looking at Hindu texts, by looking at Christian texts, by looking at the texts of the world's religion, of the world's spiritual heritage. And we are one world now. We are one world definitely now. It was already coming to towards one worldism, and then the internet came about. And now there's just no question that we are all obviously connected. Obviously, we all know everything about everybody. We all live in the world, the virtual world of the internet, which is our reality, you see. So, I just wanted to make that little pitch for those of you who feel uncomfortable, identifying yourself as Buddhist. For those of you who do identify yourself as Buddhist, well, be a Buddhist. Don't just say you're a Buddhist, but live a life like Buddha lived, you see. And a life like Buddha lived is a life of tolerance for others, love, compassion, not one of boundary setting and insider, outsider and all of that, you see. That's what Buddhism should mean. And if that's not what Buddhism means for you, then you don't understand what Buddhism really is, you see. If you think it gives you license to feel superior to other people or to feel, that other people are excluded from your little club or something like that, you say, that's not real religion at all. And there's lots of examples of non-real religion in the world, right? Has always been. Fighting each other, killing each other over religion, you see, over identity cards. So I think that there is some... Bodhicitta is a very interesting concept, and it's not just a Buddhist concept, I would say. It's a concept. It's a concept that directs us to how we need to perfume our minds. You see, the citta is the mindset, a perfume that imbues any particular thought. You see, there's a difference between a citta, a mindset, and any particular thought that occurs within that mindset. You see, but the bodhicitta informs all thought. You could say. Informs it. It's the context for all thought. So that's why, as you'll see in the text, they make a distinction between actually two kinds of bodhicitta, two kinds of the mindset of enlightenment. The first one is called the aspiring bodhicitta, aspiring, which is a kind of a thought. It is a thought. It's a particular thought. I wish, that I could be awakened so that I could really realize the interconnection between me and all other beings, you see, and generate that kind of feeling of connectedness and compassion and love for all others, you see. But that's a thought. The Then there's the second kind is activated bodhicitta. And activated doesn't mean that you have a particular thought. See, it infuses every thought. It is the context or the background for every thought. And that's real bodhicitta. And if you understand bodhicitta, you know, in a certain kind of way, this is just motivation. It's the ultimate sort of form of motivation, a spiritual motivation, you see. No matter what label you put on the spirituality that you're motivated to practice, it's the motivation for the practice of any spirituality. Really, but so I would say it like this: it is the intention behind all subsequent intentions. You see, it's a meta intention when it's activated. It's a meta intention, or you could put it like this: it is, you know, chitta also has a kind of a connotation of a wish. You know, sometimes they translate it that way too: the wish for awakening. So you could also think of bodhicitta as the desire or wish behind all wishes. All wishes, all desires are a form of the desire. What is the desire? The desire to be satisfied, content, happy, connected, not isolated, not feeling alone and isolated. That's what we all want. That's what we all want. That's the wish that informs all wishes, you see? Every time we desire something, whether it be a consumer good or an experience like going, you know, on a vacation or to a, you know, whatever. Behind every desire is the hope that this desire will fulfill desire. And then I won't have desire anymore. Right? If you analyze desire, it's very interesting because that's behind every desire. Is the hope that the itchiness will go away if I scratch it. Right? Like I was talking about last night. When the itch comes up, a desire comes up and I scratch it, then maybe I won't have any itches anymore. But that's not how you end itchiness and get to the great state of itchlessness. You see? You end it through something like bodhicitta. The desire for itchlessness. The Right? So it's the desire behind all desire. It's what we really want, in other words. And that's universal, I think. That's not just, you know, Buddhist or, you know, any other particular sectarian label. It's behind human nature. We are all desire the end of desire. That's our deepest desire. And that's exactly what the spiritual traditions lead to. That's the goal of all spiritual traditions. And you can call it, again, product differentiation. It's like going to the grocery store and going down the, you know, the cereal aisle, you know, breakfast cereal aisle, there's about how many? 500 different cereals there. But basically there's just one or two, you know, there's the cornflakes and there's the sugar. And the rest of the, you know, one or two, three, it's basically the same thing. Product differentiation, you know, you can call it moksha, you can call it mukti, you can call it nirvana, you can call it awakening, you can call it whatever you want, salvation. But it all comes to the same thing. Perfect happiness. Perfect contentment. Perfect integration into your world. Samadhi is exactly what that means. Integration. I integrate with the world around me perfectly. Lose myself in the larger whole. And that's the goal. That's the goal. And you can call it, you know, whatever you want. But all roads lead to the same goal. Yeah? So pick your road. It doesn't really matter in a way. It doesn't matter, you know. As long as it's leading to that goal, it's a proper path. See? All right, here we go. I promise not to get too diverted. I was going to go through five chapters. I already got diverted from what I was doing. Here's just quickly, okay, an overview of where we're going today and tomorrow. The chapter one is called Bodhicitta Anushamsa. Anushamsa means praise, in praise of bodhicitta. And it's kind of like what the Dalai Lama does often, if not always, at his teachings. Before he starts his teachings, he almost always, check me out, almost always tells you what you're going to get out of this. Why you should listen to what I have to say. You know? Here's a whole teaching on patience. Here's why you should pay attention. Because you'll be happier, because you'll end your anger, blah, 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 blah. And it's a little bit like that in the first chapter. Here's the advantages of bodhicitta. Then the second one is papa, papa deshana. Deshana means confession. Papa means faults or sins. You could even say evil. Okay, so the second chapter is to overcome the obstacles to bodhicitta. Okay? Overcome the obstacles. And we're going to do chapter 1 and chapter 2 in today's class. Nothing on my sleeve. The second class today is chapter 3, bodhicitta parigraha. Parigraha means embracing it. Embracing bodhicitta. And this is a chapter on how to get it. How to get that mindset of awakening. Chapter 4 will be tomorrow's first class at 1 o'clock. Bodhicitta apramada. Apramada means being not being careless. So you can translate it positively as vigilance or something like that. Vigilance about protecting bodhicitta. Once you got it, you see, how to protect it. And then the last chapter that we'll do as part of this workshop, second class tomorrow, is chapter 5, Samprajnana, Rakshana. Rakshana means guarding. Samprajnana, Anya, Samprajnana means attention or awareness. Sam means full awareness, maintaining mindfulness all day long. Which is kind of how you guard bodhicitta, by paying attention to what you're doing, what you're thinking, what you're saying, what's happening in the world around you, paying attention, waking up. Okay? So that's a pretty important class. Second one tomorrow. Bowing down with reverence to those gone to bliss. Those gone to bliss are the enlightened beings, the awakened ones, who possess the Dharma body. Dharma body is a reference to the thing that we all share, the self, you could say, the identity that we all equally share. It's sometimes identified with emptiness itself. In other words, we all ultimately are alike in being nobody. Okay? All ultimately alike in being nobody. And then we differentiate ourselves by being somebody. And that's kind of an illusion. It's a kind of an illusion that you're somebody different than other somebodies. Because ultimately we're all nobody. And you can think of that, the Dharmakaya, the Dharma body, as being that nobodiness that you've always been, actually. Okay, you don't have to acquire nobodiness. You've always been nobody. You always will be nobody. You never have not been nobody. The somebody thing is ephemeral. Somebodies come and go and change and, you know, get born and live for a while and die and then maybe come back and get somebody else and all of that. The nobodiness that underlies our real identity, that is our real identity, our true nature, our svabhava, our self-nature, is emptiness, is nobody, is the absence of being somebody. Or you could say it like this, the condition of possibility for being somebody. It is the ocean from which any and all particular waves arise. See what I mean? Are the waves the same as the ocean or different from the ocean? You could say yes. Right? Okay. Together with their offspring. Offspring means the bodhisattvas here. So you're talking about Buddhas and bodhisattvas, the fully awakened ones and those who have awakened to the possibility and the method to become fully enlightened, to become fully awakened. They've awakened to the idea of awakening, the understanding of awakening. Bowing down with reverence to all these guys and gals and all those who are praiseworthy, I will concisely describe in accordance with scripture, not just making this up, he says. Didn't just, you know, think this up in my garage last night. In accordance to the tradition with scripture, a guide to the observances, samvara means discipline or observances, restraints. A guide to the observances of the children of those gone to bliss. That means the bodhisattvas again. And that's where the title comes from. That from that verse, guide to the bodhisattva's way of life, is derived from that first verse. So he bows down. He makes prostrations, really. He honors the fact that there have been beings who have taught him this kind of stuff in the past, you see? Didn't just, like, think it up. And he does a little bit more like that. there is nothing here that hasn't been said before. And that's the truth. That's true of any spiritual teaching, actually. You know, spiritual teachers are very, you know, kind of like, it's an interesting profession because you got nothing new to say. No new material. You know? It's just the same. There's no news here, just olds. Over and over again, the same kind of thing. So the, you know, the trick is to just try to present it a little bit differently so maybe somebody will hear it differently. But it's the same stuff. Same stuff that spiritual teachers have been teaching for since time immemorial. You know, they didn't change the script here. You know, they don't go back and, like, you know, erase and, you know, put in new stuff in these kinds of teachings and scriptures and stuff like that. This is immutable truth. And it's immutable because it works. You know, the spiritual teachings work if they're practiced. So there's no need to, you know, to fool around with them, to change them, to invent new stuff. You just have to practice with the old stuff. But in order to practice it, you've got to, like, be convinced that you should practice it. And so that's the job of a spiritual teacher, really. It's like a salesman. It's like a salesman who's selling the same product over and over and over again. It's just, you know, the same Hoover vacuum cleaner. Right? And just different sales pitches. So, there's nothing here that hasn't been said before, and I have no skillfulness in composition. This is actually not true, Master Shantideva, because this is a very, very beautiful text. And if you know some Sanskrit, you will see that it's elegant, just really, really elegant and clever. This is not because of some thought that I could help others, he says. Which is kind of interesting to say in a text about helping others. God, you're right. I didn't write this because I thought I could help others with it. So why did you write it, Master Shantideva? Shantideva is the author of the text, right? The peace angel, the god of peace, Shantideva. I have composed this only in order to help sanitize. The word in Sanskrit means something like to perfume, to sanitize my own mind. In other words, I'm writing this for me. I'm writing this so that because it will help me to say these kinds of things to myself. And then he says in the next verse, because of this, the power of my goodness increases. In other words, composing a text like this increases his own virtue, right? So that I might cultivate virtue. And should another similar to me examine it, perhaps it'll have some meaning. If someone else comes along who's like me, so who's, you know, in what way are we like Master Shantideva or not? Are you interested in cleaning your mind? Are you interested in perfuming, you know, in sanitizing your own mind? And if you are, then, well, you know, this might help. You know, Shantideva says, help me to sanitize my mind. That's the only reason I really did it. You know, I don't know if I can help you or not. Depends. Depends on who? On you. See, nobody can make you do anything. Nobody can really teach you anything you don't already know. So, you know, he's saying, like, maybe this exercise that I've gone through that has helped me so much in writing 10 chapters of the Guide to Bodhisattva's Way of Life, maybe it'll help people like us who, if you're interested in changing yourself, you see. All right. Because of this, my power increases. Goodness increases. This leisure and fortune, so hard to obtain, are acquired in order to fulfill the purpose of life, purpose of human life, purushartha. Purushartha means the purpose of purpose artha of purusha. So now he's talking about, you know, a very often mentioned teaching in Buddhism, leisure and fortune, jhana and sampada. Jhana means leisure. Jhana means that we have a momentary opportunity. It literally means that. Jhana means, like, for a moment, there's an opportunity. And sampad means, and everything has fallen together nicely for us right now. We have a limited opportunity to actually get serious about a spiritual life. And he says, this leisure and fortune are so hard to obtain. So difficult. Su durlabha. You know, durlabha means hard to obtain. Su durlabha means extremely hard to obtain. To get a kind of an opportunity like we have in this life. So what's the point of it? They're acquired in order to fulfill our purpose. Why we're here? What's the point is to fulfill the point of life. We have an opportunity to fulfill the purpose of human life itself, which is what? To perfect ourselves, to reach the to reach perfect happiness. That is the ultimate purpose of life, to reach bodhi, to reach awakening. If one does not take advantage of it now, how can such a fortuitous encounter, sammagama, it means a conjunction, how could such a fortuitous encounter ever happen again? You see, rare, very rare to have the kind of life that we have. And you know, none of us really think that, because we look around and go, oh, everyone else pretty much has the same kind of life we do. But that's not the case, actually. Travel a little bit, or at least go on the internet and, you know, check out how other people are living. You know, billions of other people. And then, like, look around, you know, L.A. There's a lot of people who aren't here today. You know, that's the last thing you want to do. You know, I want to go to the Comic-Con? I'd rather go to Comic-Con. Or I'd rather go to the Dodgers game. Are the Dodgers playing in town? You know, whatever. There's a million other things that people, you know, are interested in doing than sitting around learning how to be happy. See? So you're rare. If you came here at all, if you have the inclination to come here at all, and have the ability, of course, you know, the economic ability, the educational ability, the fact that you're not being bombed, you know, that you're not living in a war zone, it's actually quite rare and very hard to attain. Just as a flash of lightning, this is a very famous verse, illuminates the darkness of a cloudy night, so too, because of the Buddha, because of the inspiration of the Buddha, does the worldly mind turn for just an instant to meritorious thought. Like a flash of lightning, once in a while, because of the inspiration of the Buddha. I want to talk about that in a second. Just once in a while, we get this like little flash of light, a flash of lightning. You know, I should try to be awakened. You know? Instead of like all the other thoughts that we go through and all the other wishes that we have all day long about, you know, all the wants and desires and things that we want. Once in a while. And again, like, where does it come from? You know, how did I think that? And well, somebody inspired you. Somebody put it, somebody touched something in you, inside yourself. Somebody woke something up inside yourself. That's the inspiration of the Buddha. So it doesn't mean that, you know, Gautama Buddha with long, you know, earlobes and golden skin came and, you know, waved his magic wand over you necessarily. The activities of the Buddha occur all over the place all the time, potentially. Waking up our own potential to be Buddhas ourselves, to be awakened ourselves. So, you know, Cindy was doing a nice little thing today about these, you know, these deities, these Hindu deities. These are outward representations of inner powers, you see, inner abilities. There's nothing outside that isn't inside. nothing spiritually outside. Nobody can come from the outside and change you, you see. You have to, at best, your understanding of things outside awaken an understanding of things inside. So that's the inspiration. Once in a while, you know, this is a verse on grace, in a way, on grace. By the grace of, you know, the Buddha, whatever you mean by that, by the grace of the, you know, powers that be, I have once in a while gotten this like idea, you know, in my mind. Oh, I should try to figure out what's what. I should try to awaken to reality, and I should try to realize that I'm not alone. That I live in interdependence with the world around. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh calls this interbeing. That we all live in interbeing. None of us are beings, you know, period. We are live in interbeing. You see? I am because you are. And you are because I am too, by the way. So it is that goodness is always weak. This is kind of like Master Shanti David being a little pessimistic, you know? Goodness is very weak. Durbala means got bad power. Little power, bad power. So it is, goodness is always weak. While the power of evil, bala, papa, is very strong. Papa means evil. Or, you know, I used to not want to translate papa as evil because, you know, we have all kinds of like Judeo-Christian, you know, connotations to evil. But, you know, I think it's a very powerful word in Sanskrit. And it kind of means that. And there is evil in the world, okay? There is evil. There is evil in us. We all have the capabilities to do very heinous things. Every single one of us. None of us is without that capability. We are all human in exactly the same way. So anything that that a serial killer can do, you have the capability of doing that too, somewhere. You see? That's kind of our default position, actually. That's what he's saying here. Our default position is to do the wrong thing. As we all know, actually, right? What's your default position when someone insults you? When somebody writes you a nasty email, what's your default position? Quit. See? And then you have to, like, restrain yourself. You know, if you're trying, if you're practicing, you have to restrain yourself from your own inclinations. So that's what he's kind of pointing out here. Goodness is weak compared to the strength of evil. Now, so it is that goodness is always weak. While the power of evil is great and very dreadful, if there were not something called the wish for full awakening, so he calls it here sambodhicitta, the full awakening of a Buddha, of an awakened one. If there wasn't this kind of possibility, this kind of intention that would inform all other intentions, what other goodness could ever overcome it? How could we ever overcome our worst inclinations, you see? How could we overcome our sort of default position of being nasty, selfish, hurtful people? This is a praise of bodhicitta, right? We're still in chapter 1. The king of the sages, that'd be, the Buddha, it's plural. So that's kind of important too. In many, many Buddhist texts, you'll see that when they talk about the Buddhas, they use the plural. Because there are lots of them. Not just one like mammoth, cosmic, monotheistic Buddha. Buddhas are all over the place. In fact, they're all in this room as potential. You see? We're all potentially Buddha. And we're all equally have the potential to be Buddhas. Nobody has more potential than anyone else. Okay? Equally. That's our Buddha, what they call a Buddha nature. We all have Buddha nature. We're all salvageable. And that's the case also in other world religions, right? That nobody's potentially excluded from being saved or from being going to nirvana or going to moksha or liberation. The kings of the sages who have been thinking about it for many eons have realized that only this is beneficial for increasing the happiness of the boundless flood of humanity, for increasing the sukha. Sukena sukum. Sukena means easily increasing your sukha, your happiness. This is the Mahasukha Center, right? It's supposed to be like happy, learning how to be happy, learning how to. So he said, there's no power that's better than this for happiness. Bodhicitta is the ultimate fuel, the afterburners for happiness. The wish to awaken should never be relinquished by those who wish to overcome the hundreds of sufferings of this world. This, by the way, is a reference. Sometimes they say a reference to, for those of you who know, to practitioners on the medium scope who want to overcome their own suffering. And then the next part of the verse, by those who wish to relieve living beings of their distress, that's a reference to the step shared with those of greater scope. The wish to awaken should never be relinquished by those who wish to overcome the hundreds of sufferings in this world. And we have hundreds of sufferings. Countless sufferings. By those who wish to relieve living beings of their distress, who want to do something for others, really. Who want to help others in the only way that you really can help others. Which is how? Change you. I said it last night. I went through the whole syllogism. Remember the syllogism? Everything is subjective. Our view of the world is subjective. The only accessible world we have ever had and ever will have is filtered through our subjectivity. So what happens if you change your subjectivity? You change the only knowable world there ever has been or ever will be. You might as well just call it the world. So when you get bodhicitta, you see, when you get this mindset, this intention behind all intentions, when you realize that there is only one desire, the desire for contentment, for awakening, when that occurs, when that arises, then the world around you changes. You help people by changing you, you see? So By those doing, and those who wish to awaken, I said that. When the wish to awaken has arisen, instantly a wretch. I intentionally use the word wretch because the only time I ever really have heard that word is in that hymn, "Amazing Grace," who saved a wretch like me. So you're saved. You're a wretch now, and you're saved. Instantly, a wretch who has been bound in the prison of this world is called the child of those gone to bliss, a bodhisattva, and becomes worthy of the respect of all those in the worlds of gods and humans. Having been cast into this impure mold, that's this kind of like understanding of who we are. Our understanding of who we are is based on two things, on a body and a mind, right? On a physical body, and the kind of mind that we are familiar with, which is a suffering mind, is an impure mold. Having kind of been born that way, one takes on the priceless form of a jewel. You transform yourself. One way you transform yourself, your mindset changes, right? Obviously, we talked about it. Bodhicitta, your mindset changes. But your relationship to your body changes too. Your relationship to your physicality also changes. Are you your body? Yes or no? Do you ever identify with your body? Yes. All the time. How old are you? Quick. How old are you? If you give me a number, you've identified with your body. You see? And you will not be saved in your body. If you identify with this, this is a physical thing. This is a material thing. It has been born. It is now living. And it will die. Definitely. Okay? Definitely. So the way to immortality is not through identifying through the physical body. Quite the opposite. This is why yoga is so oftentimes misunderstood. Yoga is meant to detach you from your physicality, not to increase your attachment to it. That's a losing proposition. You see? Anyone getting older here? And we're all on our way to death, whether we, you know, it takes 40, 50, 60, 70 years, or whether it's tomorrow. Yeah? So the identification with the body, the thinking that's who I am, is definitely going to cause death. Definitely will bring a death to you. But if you re-identify yourself with something bigger, you see, with something larger, with something non-material, then immortality is possible. We are all by nature immortal. That's the Buddha nature. That's our immortal part. But we don't identify with that part of ourselves. We identify with, you know, our physicality and whatever goes on in our minds. So instantly we like change as a result of this bodhicitta. Change our sense of identity, you see? Sense of who we are. We think of ourselves differently with a different kind of mindset like this. Its great value has been well established by those unique appraisers of the world's treasures. You know, I struggled with the translation of this, but it's kind of like, you know, an art appraiser who comes in and like decides how much a painting's worth or something like that. You know, he's saying like the awakened ones have evaluated bodhicitta, and they say like, how much is it worth? And they say like, can't put a price on it. You know, it's great value. Those is by those unique appraisers, and whose wisdom is limitless. The appraisers are limitless. The wisdom is limitless. Those disposed to vacating this worldly condition should hold on tightly to this jewel. The bodhicitta here is likened to a jewel, and that metaphor occurs over and over and over again. Actually, sometimes they say it's like a wish fulfilling jewel. It means like it's Aladdin's lamp. Because it brings you what you really want. See, the problem with us is if we had an Aladdin's lamp or a wish-fulfilling jewel, we would just like start rubbing and going, you know, boat, you know, better computer, you know, trip to Jamaica, you know. But if you have the bodhicitta, you see, the bodhicitta is the understanding of what you really want, of what it is that we really desire. We desire peace. We desire happiness. We desire connection, interconnection with other beings. We desire the end of desire. We desire contentment. All right. All other goodness wastes away like the banana tree does. I taught this text once in Singapore, or just outside of Singapore, where they have banana trees. Banana trees give bananas and then they die. Did you know that? Yeah. They got one crop. one fruition out of a banana tree. And this is an interesting verse. All other goodness wastes away like the... All other goodness wastes away. Like the banana tree is leaving behind its fruit. This is a description of karma, actually, for those of you who were here last night. Karma, you know, you create... It, you know, a little time goes by and then it brings its fruition and then that's it. You see, that karma experience is now over. So he's distinguishing karma from merit here. Karma from what's sometimes called punya. They use different words. But the tree which is the wish to awaken never dies and perpetually bears fruit. So there's several verses like this. You know, what it means is that a person who doesn't have bodhicitta, a person whose mind isn't infused with the selflessness that comes with bodhicitta. Selflessness means you understand you're part of a bigger whole. You're not just you, you see. It's a kind of a form of selflessness, right? If you identify with a network rather than just with your own, you know, body-mind complex. With the kind of selflessness that comes with bodhicitta, action changes. You can't call it karma anymore. Because it's not you doing it. You say your name to yourself is no longer operating there. You see? You've re-identified yourself as not just being an individual, but being part of the whole. And so you have to call it a whole different thing. They still act, of course. You call it punya, merit, which doesn't just go away. You see? So this is like the big advantage of bodhicitta, actually, is that once you get bodhicitta, everything you do is beneficial. And here's another reason why. Because everything you do, you dedicate to someone else. Not for you. You see? Take all the expectation and self-advantage out of it. You see? Take all the self-grasping out of the equation. And so it never sucks. It never wears out. And that's why, you know, when they say, when you get bodhicitta, when you get the mindset of awakening, you are on your way to awakening. It's kind of like the, you know, the fast track. It's the passing lane. It's the what do you call it? The commuter lane on the 405. All right. Even one, this is kind of an interesting verse. The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, if you read it, is a kind of a radical text, I have to tell you. So you get verses like this. Even one who has committed heinous bad deeds, you know, murderers, robbers, rapists, you know, CEOs who, you know, abscond with multiple millions of dollars from their companies. Even one who has committed heinous bad deeds is instantly saved by seeking protection. Why? You know, that's a karma, right? If you do heinous bad deeds, that's karma. And as I said last night, you're carrying around, where is karma stored? In your simple sense of self. Karma is stored in your present sense of who you are, which is defined by who you once were, right? Bodhicitta changes your sense of self. It changes your sense of identity. And therefore, it would change your understanding of who you once were also. Change one, you change them both, right? Change your past, you change your present. Change your present, you change your past. Your understanding of the past. So this is like, in an instant, boom. You just become a different person. And you don't have that same kind of karma. You see? You got bodhisattva karma, if they have karma at all. You got bodhisattva karma. You don't have suffering schmuck karma. You see? Difference. You become a different being. Yeah. Bodhisattva. A different being. Sattva means being. You become a being of awakened, who's on their way to full awakening, an awakened being, not a suffering being. Even one who's committed heinous bad deeds is instantly saved by seeking protection. Just like one is spared great fear by seeking the protection of a valiant warrior, you know, standing behind Xena, is that her name? That you, yeah. Standing behind Xena, you know, nobody can hurt you. And standing behind bodhicitta, nothing can touch you anymore. Can't touch this. Dun. Just like one is spared by great fear. Why is it that ignorant beings do not seek protection in it? What's wrong with us? Why don't we go for it? The only real protection there is. See, why don't we really go for it? Like the apocalyptic fire at the end of time, it instantly consumes even great bad deeds. See? Even the worst the worst sins, the worst mistakes, are instantly transformed. You see? So you can work at it. Your exercise is actually to start working on the bad deeds of the past. But the quick and easy way is to just get bodhicitta. You know, no work at all involved, really. Just instantly, you know, flash. The Sanskrit is very clear. In a moment, in a blink of an eye, you become free of your own past. And that's kind of another way of talking about the goal, actually. To be free from our past. Freedom. You know, they talk about freedom a lot as the goal. Freedom from what? You know, among other things, freedom from the past. From you being identified with your past. Who would you be if you weren't identified with your past? You wouldn't be anybody, actually. You see? Then you become not somebody anymore. You would cease to be somebody, because all of our somebody-ness is defined by our past. You would become either nobody or everybody or anybody. But you wouldn't be somebody anymore. That's freedom. All right. That's the first couple of verses. Here we go. The wish to awaken is known to be of two kinds, aspiring and activated. Remember, for those of you who were here at the beginning of class, I sort of flagged this. Aspiring is sometimes described as, you know, the thinking about bodhicitta. Remember, I said, bodhicitta, full bodhicitta, activated bodhicitta, is not a particular thought. It's not the particular I want to awaken, see, but it's the whole mindset in which all thoughts occur. It's like, it's like the room here. You see, we all are in the room, you know, and then there's like a lot of different people in the room. But the room, you see, is the place where all of us can be. So the mindset is like the room in which all the thoughts can exist, all the thoughts, feelings can come about. But it's the room, not the particular one. So that's the activated wish for enlightenment. The aspiring wish for enlightenment is a particular thought. It's not the real bodhicitta, but it's an aspiration for bodhicitta. So sometimes they describe the difference as like the difference between thinking, I'd really like to go to the Mahasukha Center and hear the class, you know, on Saturday. And so you like sit around, you think about it, and you know, you maybe make sure there's enough fuel in your car, and you know, you figure out how to get to the Mahasukha Center, and you make the plans, you see? It's like planning to go. Activated means you come. Activated means you get there. There's lots of people maybe who plan to come today. They didn't get there. Is that right? Ever happened to you? Oh yeah, I'll be there. You know? No, I couldn't come. So, too much traffic. Right? Difference between aspiring and actually doing it. Okay? Just as there is a difference between someone who wants to travel and a traveler. So I just gave an example of that image. There is known to be a similar difference between the two according to the reckoning of the learning teachers. Two kinds of bodhicitta, okay? There are great results here in samsara deriving from the aspiring wish to awaken. Okay, so he's not dissing it. He's not dissing just the mere aspiration, the mere thought. I would like to be awakened. I would like to understand how things exist. I would like to feel less isolated. Okay, he's not dissing that. He's saying even that is great results. Good changes in you. But there is not the non-stop merit. Vichinna punya. Vichinna means unbroken. Punya, merit. Not karma, merit. There is not the non-stop merit that there is with the activated wish for awakening. So that's why they say, because of the change in the room, the dimensions of the room, or the shape of the room, in the mindset, that if you change the mindset, then every thought exists within that mindset. You see? Nothing is not meritorious. So that's pretty awesome. Every single idea, every single thought, every single action becomes merit-making. And again, punya means, and it doesn't wear out, it doesn't die, it doesn't weaken. You see? Not like karma. It's a whole different thing. Store of merit. There are great results. As soon as one begins to concentrate the mind with an irreversible intention, to liberate the boundless mass of living beings. A constant, unremitting stream of merit showers down like a rain cloud, even when one is distracted or sleeping. You know, how awesome is that? You just like sleep and you're like, oh, yeah, merit, 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 merit. Distracted, I just watch TV, oh, merit, merit. Because of the change in the mindset, you see. It's really amazing, right? Sometimes they describe it like this, that there is what they call a main mind. And then there's like particular minds. You know, there's a main mind. You know, maybe think of it as mindset again. Bodhicitta affects the main mind. And then anything that goes on, any mental activity, is influenced by the main mind in which that activity is occurring. So it's quite transformational, right? The one who found reality, this is a, you know, kind of a cumbersome translation of Tathagata. Agata means coming to or going. Going or coming, it can mean either one. So I chose coming. And Tata means, you know, how things are. Thusness, literally. So the one who's come to how things are, it's a name for a Buddha. It's a name for a fully awakened one. The one who found reality, himself, made this argument in the Questions of Subahu. It's a reference to a text. For the sake of those living beings inclined towards the foundational vehicle, this is what they call Hinayana, the foundational vehicle. A well-intentioned, so just a reference to a text, actually. It's just referring to, like, you know, Buddha said the same kind of stuff in another text. A well-intentioned person who just thinks, I will relieve living beings of small things like headaches, acquires limitless merit. That's kind of cool. You know, if somebody has a headache and you say, could I give you an aspirin? You know, that's pretty good. You get, like, you know, a big reward out of that. How much more the wish to remove the incomparable pain, not just the headache, but the incomparable pain of each and every one. You see, this is another different. This is another feature of what of bodhicitta, is that it's omni, O-M-N-I. It's all embracing. It doesn't pick and choose between people that you like and people you don't like. I'll help the people that I like. I'll ignore the people I don't like when they're suffering. I'm not like that. All embracing. Because you realize that they are not different from you. You're connected. Your identity shifts. You find yourself in a nexus, you see. So it's not like, well, they're other than me, so why should I help them, you see. This is why we help people that we do help, actually, is because we do feel connected. We feel that in some sense they're part of us. We'll help our children, we'll help our loved ones, our, you know, mothers and fathers, we'll help our close friends. But then there's all these other ones that, you know, well, they're not me. I don't have any relationship with them. Why should I help them? You see, bodhicitta changes all that. Changes that whole understanding of how we exist in the world. I am because you are. You are because I am. You see, we exist interdependently like that. So even in their dreams, this special wish has not been previously arisen among these beings. You know, most people don't even have a wish like this occur, even in their dreams, he says. Not even out of self-interest, let alone out of concern for others. So we don't have this kind of understand, this kind of thought, even when we kind of know it's in our self-interest to do, to have that kind of attitude. It doesn't even arise then. How is it that this distinctive, unprecedented jewel is born in someone? Should be an is there, I guess. How is this distinctive, unprecedented jewel born in someone? When among others, thinking about another's welfare doesn't even occur when it's in one's self-interest. How did it happen? It's kind of like, there's a lot of head scratching in the first chapter. Like, how can this kind of bodhicitta, this mindset even arise? It's so amazing that it could arise in anyone's mind, you know. How can the merit be measured of this seed of worldly joy? The thing that brings happiness, jagat ananda. Ananda is bliss. Jagat means for the whole world. Bliss for the whole world. How can the merit be measured of this seed of worldly joy, of this medicine for the world's suffering, of this jewel of the mind? Again, jewel metaphor. Here's another like great, sort of rad verse in the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. Just having a single altruistic thought is better than the worship of the Buddhas. This is a Buddhist text. This is one of the things that you can find in, I think, a number of traditions, but especially in Buddhism, of the Buddhist teaching to not be such a Buddhist. You see, if you want to be a Buddhist, don't be such a Buddhist, worshipping the Buddhas. Oh Buddha, oh Buddha, Buddha. Oh Namo Buddha, Buddhaya, you see. Be nice to other people. A single altruistic thought, in a kind of very, very strong statement. A single altruistic thought is better than all your pujas to all your tankas and all your statues and all of that. You see? Be nice to other people. Jesus said something of the same kind of thing. He said, you know, feed the poor, house the homeless, you know, visit people in jail, and then you have done it for me. Then you have visited me, you see? Because the Christ is in all of us. The Buddha is in all of us, you see? Not some guy on Alpha Centauri somewhere. You see, inside of us, inside of other beings. Even a single altruistic thought. How much more so the effort exerted on behalf of the welfare of all. This is the activated bodhicitta. Although people want to eliminate their suffering, they actually just run to embrace it. Isn't this true? We're all masochists in denial. You know, we say, no, I don't want to suffer. And then we over and over and over again do exactly the thing that causes us to suffer. They actually just run to embrace it. Although they just want to be happy because of delusion, they destroy it as if it were the enemy. Destroy any happiness-making qualities as if it were the enemy. And run like moths to flame to suffering and the causes of suffering. One who brings the fulfillment of all happiness for those starving for happiness, and who constantly severs all the afflictions of those who are afflicted, who also obliviates delusion. Where is there a saint, a sadhu? Where is there a saint equal to this? Where is there such a friend? Where is there a mitra? Right? Like Maitri. Mitra means friend. Maitri means friendliness. Where's a friend like this? Where is there such punya, merit? One who reciprocates when someone does something for them is praised to some extent. Right? If you say, like, you know, somebody gave me a present, so I'll give a present back. Well, that's a good thing to do. Somebody said, that's a good thing to do. You've reciprocated. What can be said about a bodhisattva who is totally unpreoccupied with his own welfare? You know, now kind of hearkening back to last night's teaching a little bit. Who acts not out of any self-interest whatsoever. See, just because it's the right thing to do. Not because, like, somebody gave me something in the past so I got to return it, or, you know, or because other people will praise me if I do it and think highly of me or something, but simply because it's the right thing to do. Completely unpreoccupied with his own welfare. People honor a do-gooder. People honor as a do-gooder one who offers a feast. Somebody who invites you over, you know, for a party or something like that, puts on a big party. Even if it's just for a few people. Okay, there's not that many people there. So it's kind of a small party, but that's still good. Even if the food that's given lasts only for a moment, you know, maybe it's Chinese food or something. And you're hungry an hour later. Even if it's only enough to support life for half a day. So it wasn't Chinese food, it was Italian. It got me through the morning, 6 hours or something. Half a day. Oh, thank you. People say, oh, what a generous person that you provided this party and gave us something to eat that didn't last. Even if it's given contemptuously, at least they gave it, you know. It was like, you know, maybe they're putting on like some dinner for the homeless and are looking down on the homeless, but are thinking, oh, you know, such a benefactor. So what about the one who completely satisfies everyone? See, again, the omni nature of bodhicitta. Satisfies every one of the heart's desires of an unlimited number of living beings. Omni, omni, omni here, right? Stretching over the course of limitless time. A commitment that is imperishable, lasting until suffering beings whose number fills all of space achieve their ends. What about that one? See, you may praise this other, you know, person who put on the party. What about somebody like this? See, remember, what's the name of the chapter? In praise of bodhicitta. The protector has said, protector means another word for Buddha, he who has foul thoughts arise in his heart toward the Lord of feasts, still playing on that kind of dinner metaphor, right? Party metaphor. The Lord of feasts
is a bodhisattva, the child of the victor. So somebody who, like, you know, has bad thoughts about somebody like that will dwell in the hell realms for as many eons as the number of such foul thoughts that have arisen. So, you know, kind of like fire and brimstone here a little bit. But still, you can see, like, why it might not be good for you to diss a person like this. You know? You don't have to, like, believe in hell realms to kind of realize that this might not be, you know, like, a really good thing for you to do. It'd be like, you know, if Jesus walked in the room and you recognized Jesus as Jesus and you went up and spat in his face or something like that. Probably not a good mental imprint, you know? Mother Teresa comes in and, you know, you slap her around a bit. You bitch slap Mother Teresa. You know, that's what he's talking about here. He's talking about that kind of effect that it could have on your own mind to diss people like this, to diss somebody like this. But one whose mind is favorably inclined will because of that bear abundant fruit. Evil done toward the children of the conquerors requires great force. It kind of takes a lot of effort to do bad things, actually. Especially something like that, you know? But goodness towards them is done effortlessly. It's easy to be, you know, respectful and kind to someone who's obviously so kind and compassionate and selfless. See, it's... So now he's talking about a different kind of inclination that we have. We do have the inclination also. We have the inclination for evil in all of us, but we also have the inclination to love and to be compassionate. And we all do. I mean, unless you're a sociopath, everyone has some version of compassion and love in their hearts. See, so when you see somebody who has kind of perfected that, who has brought those qualities to its highest level, it's easy to admire them. Because, like, you admire that in yourself. You admire that part of you. And then you see it in someone else, and it's easy, right? All right, that's chapter one. Chapter two. Papadeshana, the clearing away of papa. Papa means negative things. I mean, if you don't like the word evil, I kind of translated it as evil. Confession, but I also translated it here as confession of negative deeds, didn't I? Or do you still have that?
Yes.
Chapter 2? So, just in case you didn't like evil. So this is like, well, so what's keeping us from achieving this kind of mindset, you see? How come it doesn't arise in us? It would be so good. The first chapter is like, you're supposed to finish the first chapter and go, yeah, you know, I want that. I want what that guy has. I want what that guy has. I want, you know. Now, how do I get it, Master Sandeep? He says, well, first, you got to clean up your act. See? First, you got to, you know, kind of eliminate, purify the negativities that are in your mind. So that's what this chapter is about. And deshana can also mean confession, which is, you know, the first step to purifying those negativities is to admit that you got them. You see? And most of us are having a hard enough time with just even that, right? Of actually admitting. I mean, unless you've got, like, you know, the kind of low self-esteem that just likes to dwell on how bad a person you are all the time. You know, if you have kind of, like, good, healthy unhappiness, like, you know, most of us do, you know, it's kind of hard to admit that you've made mistakes. It's hard for all of us to admit. But guess what? We all have. We're all the same in that. I said that last night, right? There's many ways in which we are all the same, exactly the same. And one of them is that we all make mistakes. Every single human being, by definition, makes mistakes. You see? And so this is, like, you know, number one, to like admit that in yourself and not to feel so isolated and alone. You know, you're what do you call it? You're in bad company, right? We all make mistakes. Number two, to then, you know, have some compassion for others who are making mistakes. It helps us with this very, very important virtue of forgiveness. To recognize that we all make mistakes, that I make mistakes, that you make mistakes, to recognize that helps us forgive those who are making mistakes. They're just like you. They made a mistake. Whether or not they admit it or not, you know, everyone makes mistakes. And forgiveness doesn't require them to admit that they made a mistake. Okay? For,
Forgiveness doesn't require that they come to you and say, please forgive me, I'm such a bad person, I know I hurt you. So that's our dream of forgiveness. That's our dream that, you know, the person that we're harboring a grudge towards or very, like, who have hurt you very badly will come on their hands and knees and, like, you know, do some namaste. Namaste. I'm so sorry. I haven't slept a wink for 5 years thinking about what I did to you. And then we'll, like, you know, kind of like the Pope or something. All right. It's true. You were very, very mean to me, very nasty to me, but blah, blah, blah. Now go in peace, my son or daughter. You know, it's just cartoon. It's just a cartoon, not going to happen. I've given that rap, I think, now to maybe 3,000 or 4,000 people. One person came up to me at the end of the thing saying, no, somebody really did that. Somebody really came to me and they apologized. That's about your odds, okay? 1 in 3,000 or so. And every day that goes by that you don't forgive is another day that you ruin your life for yourself. You see? So the mistakes. We all make mistakes. So this is a chapter about mistakes. In order to truly obtain this jewel, which is the wish, I honor those who have found reality. Tathagata again. I honor that stainless jewel, which is the true Dharma. So this is this chapter actually, I forgot to say, has four divisions to it. This is just kind of clearing the throat here. He's kind of going for refuge here, right? He's making homage to the, you know, the powers that be, the higher powers, right? I honor those offspring of the Buddha, reservoirs. So then the first part of the first division of this chapter is offerings, making offerings. Then there's, actually you'll see it. There's offerings, prostration, which means kind of paying respect. He's already kind of done the prostration here, but it comes again later. Offerings, prostration, going for refuge, what's going to help me, going for safety, and the fourth one is called purifying the bad deeds. Fourth one is the actual purification process. So now begins the offerings. And this one I'm going to go through kind of quickly in the interest of time. Okay? These are very, very beautiful verses. I won't go through them one by one. You can read them. But they're just long, long passages of all the kinds of offerings he's going to offer to the beings, the forces that he's kind of invoked here in the first verse, right? Those who have found reality, the Buddhas, the enlightened beings, the awakened ones, to the true Dharma, true teachings, in whatever sort of package they come in, you see? Whatever label you put on, Buddhist, Hindu, Christian, Jewish, Islamic, whatever, the true Dharma is the same Dharma everywhere. I honor those who have found reality. I honor the jewel, which is the teachings that exist in the world that bring people to happiness. And I honor the offspring of the Buddha. Here standing in for Sangha, actually. So this is an example of the Sangha jewel as those who have bodhicitta. The ones who have achieved bodhicitta, bodhisattvas, stand in for Sangha. Sangha means community. Or you can think of it as, I honor all those in the community of people who are trying to live good lives. Who are trying, at least, to be part of the solution instead of more problems. So he's invoked them, now he's going to offer to them. Okay? All that, so the first verses here concern offerings that belong to no one. So there's three kinds of offerings, right? There's offerings of stuff that you have. There's offerings that belong to no one, and there's offerings of your own practice, of your own, you know, kind of activity, life. Notice that there isn't a category for offerings of things that belong to other people. So if you just look, all the flowers and fruits and types of healing remedies there are, all the jewels there are in the world, etc. Go right on down. Now, you know, you guys can read this later. Not quite, if you want. These are quite beautiful verses about, you know, the kind of thing that you'd like to offer. I'd like to offer you all the jewels in the world, all this, all that, you see. I just wanted to point out in verse 6 here, I've translated keeping this all in mind. Another translation that apparently, this is a translation from the Sanskrit, and it's a little, sort of a literal translation. Apparently, in the Tibetan, it's possible. There's a Tibetan version of later Tibetan version translation, actually Tibetan translation of the Sanskrit of this text. And apparently, it's possible to translate that phrase, keeping this all in mind, as "I imagined in my mind." So these are kind of offerings that belong to no one, that you can kind of just imagine that you're offering. You see, mountains and jewels and this and that, sunsets, and you know, you'll see when you do the reading. Verse 7, I am without merit and destitute. I have nothing else to use to pay honor. You know, I don't got nothing here. So I'll just imagine stuff, right? So for my sake, may the protectors who wish only for the welfare of others accept this which I've done to the best of my ability. So then the next verses, beginning in verse 8, are offerings of something they own, of you, that you own. Right? Offerings that no one owns is the first one. Now offerings of things that you own, and primarily these are about your own body. These verses concern your own body. I give myself completely and totally to the conquerors and their offspring. You know, take me into your arms. And then he says, with devotion I place myself in your service. Dasa, dasatva. You know, we were listening to Krishna Das earlier at the yoga class this morning. Das means servant. Krishna Das is the servant of God, servant of Krishna. So he says, I'm putting myself in the service of the conquerors and their offspring of the Buddhas, the awakened ones, and the Bodhisattvas. Then the third kind of offering begins on verse 7. These are offerings of that they call emanations of one's own thoughts, which is just kind of like wishes. You know, they're just like, it's like that old temptation song, you know, just my imagination, right? So just in your imagination, you think of like all these awesome things that you could offer, you see. And you'll see, you know, if you do the reading, he gets quite like flowery. His imagination runs wild a bit. So there's many verses like that, actually. It goes on for a while. And right through verse 23. So we'll pick up at verse 24. Okay? Hope you don't mind that I skip over those verses, but how many did I say? 300-400 to get through and 400-500? So 24. 24 begins the second thing. First part of the chapter was what? Offering. Second part is? Prostration. I bow down with prostrations as numerous as the atoms in all the Buddhist fields. He's still doing just my imagination here. Yeah, he's imagining, you know, like himself doing as many prostrations as there are atoms in the universe to the Buddhas of all three times, past, present, and future. That's what three times means. Together with the Dharma and the Supreme Assembly, Buddha Dharma Sangha. I pay homage to the sacred places, Chaitya, to the pilgrimage sites and other sacred places. Oh, and pilgrimage spots of the Bodhisattva. So he's prostrating also to the places that have been made sacred by the presence of sacred people, and that's the only sacrality sacred places have. There's nothing intrinsically sacred about, you know, any place, Bodh Gaya or, you know, what, the Vatican, or what's that place in Salt Lake City? You know, nothing intrinsically sacred about Mormon Tabernacle. Nothing intrinsically sacred. The sacrality is lent to that place by the presence of sacred people. So he's bowing down to that kind of stuff. I make obeisance to the praiseworthy teachers and ascetics. So he's done his prayer. That's two verses. That's prostration. Now we move to the third part. What's the third part? Refuge. Going for refuge. They say in the Buddhist text that you should go for refuge. Go for safety, for protection, out of two motivations. Fear is number one. You know, and like nobody sort of likes to talk about fear, especially in a spiritual context. Like, you know, you're supposed to like, you know, kind of try to get over fear or something, but there's a place for fear in spiritual life. There's a good, healthy fear of like what life would be like if you don't pursue a spiritual life. And I think most of us know what life is like without a spiritual guideline, without a spiritual guidance. You know, I remember. And it was a nightmare to have no refuge, you see, not to know what to do. When people who don't have spiritual tools
are confronted with the realities of life, the vicissitudes of life, they are just at loss. Just like squirm around and try to find something, you know, drink or, you know, whatever it is to, you know, try to make it go away. And they have no tools. And so have some fear for that, you know, and realize, well, you know, doing the right thing isn't easy. But it's a lot easier than experiencing the wrong thing again. You know what I mean? The ramifications of doing the wrong thing. It's a lot easier to just, you know, jimmy up the courage and the guts and the virya, you know, the joyful effort to do the right thing than it is to experience the consequences of doing the wrong thing. So I go for refuge to the Buddha until the essence of waking man. Now he's talking about refuge. Oh, so I said the other one. Fear. There was two reasons to go to refuge. Fear and faith. Faith means you have some faith that the objects of that you're going to for refuge can help you. And the primary refuge, I'll just tell you right now. You know, they say in Buddhism, this is a Buddhist text, go for refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The real refuge is in the Dharma. The effective refuge is in the Dharma. The Dharma is the teachings. The Dharma is the guidelines on how to live a good life. Buddhas bring you those guidelines. Sangha helps you, like, you know, try to, you know, kind of reinforce, you know, the best in each other. But the Dharma's the real power. That's the powerhouse. I go for refuge to the Buddha until the essence of awakening is reached. That means essence of awakening, Bodhi Munda, means until all beings get it. Until all beings are awakened. I go for refuge in the Dharma and the assembly of Buddhas. These are the objects of refuge. I pray with hands folded to the fully awakened ones residing in all the directions and also also to the bodhisattvas, beings of great compassion. So that's refuge, actually. That's all. Now the fourth one. Fourth division. First one was what? Offering. Second one?
Prostration.
Third one, refuge. Now we get to the main show. Now we get to the part of the chapter that lends its name to the whole chapter. Purifying bad deeds. Okay, so you've you've done the kind of preliminary practices to purification. You've called up some serious help, right? You've called up some help. You know, help me, all you powers that are outside and inside, both that live outside and inside, in the outer world and in the inner world. The Buddhas are within you. There are no Buddhas who are not within you. Okay? So you're calling up this kind of power in you. I pray with hands folded to the fully awakened ones, etc. Whatever bad deeds, papa, again, whatever bad deeds, that's another translation of papa. Negative deeds, bad deeds, evil deeds, whatever you want to call it. You get the idea, right? Mistakes, which is like, that's kind of a light version, L-I-T-E. Yeah. Whatever bad deeds I, beast that I am, pashu in Sanskrit means a domesticated animal. It means like a cow or a horse or something. Whatever bad deeds I, beast that I am, have done or caused others to do, and we do this, we encourage other people to do the wrong thing, especially if we think it's in our self-interest to have friends who are kind of like joining forces, you know. So, like, for example, when someone insults you, or insults your friend, let's say, you know, and you say, well, you should, you know, get back at her. That's what he's talking about here. And then we feel like, oh, that's an act of loyalty to my friend. You see, we mistake this kind of encouragement for others to do bad things as something positive that we're doing for our friend. It's just a complete misunderstanding. So he's asking for, you know, he's confessing the bad deeds that he's done and the bad deeds he's encouraged other people to do. Whether it was here in this lifetime or in any previous lifetime in beginningless samsara. So, you know, kind of comprehensive confession. And whatever I foolishly and self-destructively applauded. Self-destructively applauded is an interesting phrase. It means things like being like joyful when another person is assassinated sleeping in their own home. Do you know who I'm talking about here? I was in Australia at the time, and I saw on television
I'm an American in Australia, and I was more than embarrassed. I was humiliated to watch my countrymen jump for joy, you know, celebrating the death of a murdered man. Okay? Self-destructively applauding bad deeds. Okay, he's a terrorist, okay? I'm not saying he wasn't a terrorist. But to get really, really happy about the death of anyone is not good for you. Self-destructive. It's a self-destructive seed that you plant in your mind. And whatever I foolishly and self-destructively applauded, I confess those transgressions, tormented by the pain of regret. So here's the first of what they call the four forces. The four forces of purification. This is kind of important because this will be your exercise. Your exercise is to get rid of some bad stuff in your conscience, to get rid of the bad stuff. And the presentation in this is somewhat, in the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, is somewhat different than the order that some of you have learned it in. The first one is regret. First one is to say, you know, I wish I hadn't have done that. I wish I hadn't felt happy when my government assassinated another human being. Let alone, like, you know, send drone bombers, drone planes to kill, you know, civilians. I wish I didn't applaud that. I wish I hadn't have done that. Or whatever it is that you're trying to get rid of. Regret. Good, healthy regret. There's a difference between guilt and regret. Okay? Guilt doesn't do anyone any good. Just makes you feel bad and it doesn't change anything. You see? Guilt is oftentimes used as an excuse not to feel regret. If we just feel guilty enough, if we beat ourselves up enough, maybe we don't have to feel the regret that always entails change. See, regret entails an intention not to do it again. I regret it. It's like the difference. Regret is like, you know, the one image that's sometimes used is it's like if I took a sip of this water right here, and then someone said, "Oh, there was cyanide in that water," I would have regret. I regret that I drank that water. There was cyanide in it. But he wouldn't feel, "Oh, I'm such a bad person. I'm just trash. I'm just like, oh, I feel so guilty." Yeah, it's the same thing, you see? The difference between regret and guilt is very important. Regret in the Buddhist sort of categorization of things, regret is the only negative thought that has positive connotations. It's a negative thought, right? It's not a happy thought. It's not a happy-producing thought. But it has positive connotations. All the rest, anger, desire, envy, all the rest, you know, are purely negative. But regret is both negative and positive. Kind of interesting. "And whatever I foolishly and self-destructively applauded, I confess those transgressions, tormented by the pain of regret. Whatever offenses of body, speech, or mind I committed out of disrespect towards the three jewels, my mother or my father, my gurus." Here he's talking about like big objects, important objects, karmic objects, high karmic objects. Your teachers, the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and the parents. Teachers, parents, and the three jewels. "Whatever heinous bad deeds done by me, corrupted by many faults, dosha, I confess them all to you, my guides." So confession, regret and confession come together, actually. Confession is a kind of regret, isn't it? Yeah. "How can I be rid of this?" And now he goes into some verses on how to generate some real regret with the fear of death. Okay? You know, Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life is not for the faint-hearted. You see, this isn't like some like New Age self-help book, where you're not going to kind of go down and dirty and get like in your face about, you know, the realities of things here. "How can I be rid of this? Come quickly to my rescue. May death not come for me too soon, while my bad deeds are still alive and well." And death can come for us at any time, can't it? So this is kind of like supposed to like stick put a stick up your butt a little bit, you know? Fire under the bottom. To get going, you know, you can't just like sit there with all this crap on your conscience, tick, 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 ticking. You know, someday the bomb's going to go off, and then that's it. "Death, killer of the complacent. Vishramba." Vishramba means the chilled out, relaxed, the complacent. Death, the killer of the complacent, does not take into account what has been done and left undone. Neither the healthy nor the sick can be confident that it won't come suddenly like a great flash of lightning again. Kind of picking up that earlier metaphor. Death is like a great flash of lightning too. Can happen at any time. Boom. I have done all kinds of bad deeds on account of my friends and enemies. You know, bad deeds towards your enemies, and bad deeds because you're thinking you're being friendly to your friend as they do bad deeds towards others. You see what I mean? Allying with people who are doing bad deeds. And not realizing that when it's time to go, everything must be left behind. Friends and enemies alike, you're not going to have them anymore. You're gone. They're gone. They will. When you die, you will not remember anything of this life. Do you believe me?
Yeah.
Well, if I mean, people say, no, I have past and future lives. Well, you know, who were you in your past life? So, what race were you? What language did you speak? What gender were you? Were you even a human being? Were you an animal? I don't know. What were your names of your children? I don't know. Right? And it'll be just like that. It'll go. I'll just go. The bubble will pop. You know, whether there's a future life or not. You're not going to remember it. You're not going to remember this life and your future lives. So it's all just going to go. And guess what? Your friends and also your enemies will forget about you in what? 20 years? Maximum? 30? 40? Maximum? And you know, how many decades do you want before everyone forgets you? Because it's not going to be that many. You're not Cleopatra, you know. You know, you're not Napoleon, where people will remember you for generation after generation. There'll come a time where people will just like, you know, they'll throw out the last photograph. Somebody will say, well, who's this? Oh, I don't know, it's somebody Granny knew. You know, I think it was somebody in our family. What's his name? I don't know. That's it. That's the last time anyone will ever think of you. See, it's all going to be gone. I have done all kinds of bad things on account of friends and enemies, not realizing that when it's time to go, everything must be left behind. Enemies will not be there anymore, nor friends, nor myself. Nothing will remain. Right? Whatever is experienced will become just a memory. Smarana. Like a smriti, like a smarana, same word. It'll be a karmic imprint. You know, if you believe in the future lives, it will carry on, but as a kind of a subconscious or even unconscious imprint. And that's all. Like the experience of a dream, gone, never to be seen again. That's what this life is like. Life is but a dream. Row, row, row your boat. That means where? Row, row, row your boat. It means like, you know, get going. Let's get going. Let's get busy. Gently. You know, chill out. Nice, calm, gently down the street of life. Merrily, merrily. Happy. Sukha, mahasukha, merrily, merrily. Because life is but a dream. And someday it'll be gone. You'll wake up or go to sleep or sign or whatever. But this version of a life will be gone. Already here in this life, many friends and enemies have departed after living just for a while. How many people do you know personally who have died already? You see, I know plenty. More all the time. The older you get, the more people you know who died. And you're just like that. You're not different. It will happen to you, for sure, someday. Just like it has happened to your, you know, father, mother, grandparents, friends. I had friends die on me from the time I was 15. My best friend was murdered when he was 15. You know, people die. That's reality, isn't it? This is not illusion. It's not fantasy. But again, like I was talking about last night, this is, you know, not, we don't like to think about this, and we're not encouraged to think about this in our consumer culturalist society, because it's not good for sales. Literally. It's not good for sales to realize, well, you know, we're all going to die someday, and we don't know when. You know, why should I buy a new car then? You know, good, it's a lot of money. Car still running? Good old car still running, see? It's kind of based on the avoidance of the fact of finality in our lives, the fact of terminus, that it won't last forever. Already in this life, many people have died, but because of the bad deeds they committed, terrible things lie ahead. It doesn't just go away, it doesn't just evaporate. I have not considered that I too am ephemeral because of delusion, attachment, and hatred. Those are the three poisons that we were talking about last night. Ignorance, delusion, attachment means desire and attachment, grasping. And hatred means aversion.
I've done all kinds of bad things. See, if you wanted to do this practice, I'm going to ask you to do this practice over the course of this next week or so. If you wanted to do this practice, you could reread these verses, you know, and make it you who's the first person pronoun here. You see, I have done these things. Life is ceaselessly wasting away, night and day, and there is no way to add to it. Every moment that goes by is one less that you have to live in a finite number. And there is no way to add to it. How can it be that I will not die? How can I, you know, what kind of denial am I in to think that I'm not going to die? Although in bed in the midst of my relatives, it is I alone who must endure the feeling of intense pain. They can't help me. They can't help me. They can say, oh, we're sorry, or no, please don't go, or we wish we could help you. They can't help you. It is I alone who must endure the feelings of intense pain. When I am grabbed by death's messengers, what can my relatives and friends do? Then merit will be my only protection. Punya. What I have done selflessly in life, you see, not selfishly. What kind of a life have I led is the only thing that can help you, if it's a good life, you see. And good is defined, okay? Good life is defined as selfless. Relatively. Of course, this has to be relative. But relatively selfless. A truly selfless life is an enlightened life. A truly selfless life is an awakened being's life. So we're just kind of have to be somewhere on the continuum. But you know the difference, right? Between something that's pretty selfish and something that's relatively selfless. And that's the selfless actions that are the punya. Those are not that's not the karma. That's not the karma that you'll take with you in your, you know, that you'll experience maybe later. The punya is the thing that will help you, and does also carry over too, but will help you when you die. You will have no regrets. You can put it like that. Actions that you don't regret in any way at all. Pure. As pure as possible. The merit will be my only protection. Because of my attachment to this transitory life, and by not thinking about this terrifying thing of death, I have carelessly acquired many bad deeds, O Protector. Even now, when someone is taken for an amputation, even now means in 8th century India. You know what it means to be taken for an amputation? It means a criminal who has been taken to have his hands cut off or something, or legs cut off or something like that. That's what is meant by the amputation. Even now, when someone is being taken out of the jail and being led to wherever they do... is there another word for amputation? Chopping? You know what I mean? Even now, his mouth becomes parched with thirst. That means scared shitless, okay? He sees the world differently through wretched eyes, as you can imagine. You imagine that the world would not look the same to you as you're marching to the guillotine or something like that, right? How much more when one is overcome by the frightener, Bhairava, actually, the frightener and the messengers of death? How much more are you going to be scared, you see? Possessed with feverish terror, he will be covered in his own excrement. So the S word that I used just a while ago is actually in the text. No complaint. Sacred Sanskrit text. Desperately, I will look around in all directions, searching for protection. Where is the good person who will serve as my defender from this great fear? Fear of death is a great fear. The fear of death is the greatest fear. Because the fear of death is the fear that I will be no more. You see? And it's very interesting. It's our greatest fear and our greatest desire simultaneously. Our greatest desire is that I, say your name to yourself, will no longer be also. That I will transcend my individuality and become something bigger and larger than the mere I that I am now. But the fear of death is the exact same fear. Fear of losing the self. If we knew for sure that there was a next life or a, you know, afterlife or something like that, the fear of death wouldn't be so great, I think. But even those with great faith have some version of the fear of death because they're not sure. Nobody's sure. Anybody who sits around and tells you, I know for sure what happens to you after you die, is just lying to you. No one knows for sure. Okay? So because of that uncertainty, will I survive? There's great fear involved. That's the attachment to the I, you see. That's how strong the attachment to the I is. Desperately I look around. Who's going to help me? Seeing that there's no protection coming from any quarter, I will revert to complete confusion. Moha is one thing, confusion. Sammoham is like way up. You know, you just go like a chicken cut off with its head cut off. What will I do in this state of Mahabhaya? Maha, great fear. So right now, I go for refuge. So this is the second force now. I go for refuge. First force was what? Regret. In the form of confession, actually. Second form is called the foundation force sometimes. Going for refuge. And so right now, I go for refuge to the protectors of the world, to those with great strength, the conquerors who strive to guard the world, to remove all anxiety. I earnestly go for refuge to the Dharma. Which, like I said before, you know, in my opinion, my understanding is the real refuge. The real refuge is I go for refuge in the truth as I have learned it. And I will, and that will really help you, you see. That's a real protection, which destroys the fear of cyclic existence, samsara. It destroys the fear that defines samsara. We live in fear. Another way of talking about nirvana is the great fearlessness, the dropping of all fear. Yeah? What's extinguished? Nirvana means extinguishing. Well, you know, what's extinguished? Well, among other things, fear, anxiety, stress, wondering what's going to happen next. Because you've completely accepted reality as it is, you have no fear. Have no fear at all. Trembling with fear, in the meantime, we tremble with fear. And, you know, then he starts giving himself to all these bodhisattvas. And there's kind of no need for me to go into it here. Because really, if you're going to use this text as a practical thing, you've got to figure out who and what it is that you're going to go to refuge for. You know, when you're trying to find help in the dark, as you're having your dark night of the soul, which hopefully you're going to have every day this week, you know, as you work on these four forces. You know, where is the refuge for you? You see? Refuge in your teachers, refuge in what you've learned in the Dharma, refuge in your own understanding of the Dharma. You know, where is the refuge for you? They also say there's a difference between just reciting verses like this, I go for refuge, and actually going for refuge. It's like standing out in a rainstorm and going, umbrella, umbrella, umbrella. And actually opening the damn umbrella, you see what I mean? So keep that in mind too. Not just words, you know. It's actually doing it. Having ignored your instructions, skipping to 53. Having ignored your instructions, I am faced with this fear, terrified. I now go to you for refuge. Swiftly take away this fear. Fearful even of a passing ailment. I'm fearful of getting a cold. One would not neglect the doctor's orders. Well, you know, take echinacea. How much more when afflicted with 404 more serious diseases? This apparently, according to the commentaries, is the number of mental afflictions. This is an estimate of the number of mental afflictions, 404. And we're all afflicted with them. All of them. So now we've come to the force of what they call the antidote. Pratipaksha in Sanskrit. Pratipaksha means the other wing, literally. Pratipaksha. It's the opposite force. You see, you got a negative force with the papa, with the bad deeds. Pratipaksha is the opposite force that evens it out. You can think of it like that. That balances you. So what is it? Even one of these can kill all the inhabitants of the Jambudvipa continent. This is our continent. In the sort of ancient Indian mythology, this is the continent that this world is on. In the kind of giant cosmic sort of geography. So even one of these can kill all the inhabitants of the Jambudvipa continent, and there is no cure to be found anywhere. There's no cure for mental afflictions except for what? Dharma. The Dharma.
the teachings, the truth. Were I to spurn the advice of the omniscient physician, the Buddha is often referred to as the doctor, you know, Dr. Feelgood. He's the doctor that like has got the cure, you know. The instructors, the great beings, the great awakened ones have got the cure, they got the medicine. And then they prescribe it. Right? This is a prescription. This is one big prescription. But then what has to happen?
Take it.
Yeah, you have to take the medicine. Otherwise, a doctor can't cure anybody. See, doctor can't cure anybody who doesn't take the medicine. Doctor can provide the medicine. Doctor can prescribe the medicine. The medicine itself is the teachings. But you got to take it. You got to take the teachings and put them into practice. So, were I to spurn the advice of the omniscient physician who extracts the cause of all pain, shame on me, I'd be an off-the-charts idiot. I'm actually kind of proud of this translation because the Sanskrit is atyanta. Atyanta means beyond limits. Mohita. Idiot. Beyond limit idiot. Off-the-charts. I am very careful when I'm on the edge of even a small precipice. You know, even when you're on a wall 5 feet high or something, you know, balancing on the wall, you're kind of careful not to fall, right? What about when on a cliff that seems to go on forever for thousands of miles? You know, talking a little cosmically here. It's not right that I should just relax and say, death will not come today. Yeah, procrastinate. So then procrastinate. I'll get to cleaning my conscience later. You know, I got plenty of time. I'm a yogi. I do yoga and I'm vegan. I'm a vegan. I'm a yogi, and and what else? I don't drink alcohol.
Prius.
And,
drive a Prius.
I drive a Prius with very safety features. Come on, none of that will save you. None of that offers any real protection. How many dead yogis do you think there are in the world? You know? How many yogis get hit by trucks every day? Oh, this is LA, right? I got to kind of emphasize this. You know, before yoga kids, there was jogging. In the beginning, there was jogging. And there was a very famous jogger,
Jim Fix.
Jim Fix was like the poster boy for jogging. He was like the world's most, the celebrity of jogging. He was on the TV all the time, on talk shows, wrote books. Dropped dead at the age of 50-something? Early 50s. After a run. Top shape, you know? Top shape. And then we go, This is the things that make you go, right? Those kinds of things make you go, That's bizarre, we say. That's just so bizarre. And by saying it's so bizarre means we don't have to take it seriously, actually. We don't have to think like, you know, no matter how many miles you jog a day or how many downward facing dogs you do, you could drop dead at any time. And not by a truck even. He had some, I did research on this. He apparently had some genetic hereditary kind of whatever it was that popped finally. Yeah, it was a sorry. I think he had a heart attack. It popped. And all that jogging and all of that didn't do a bit of good to save him from what was already in there, you see. Yeah. All right, so anyway, it's not right that I should just relax and say, death will not come today. It will come. You can be sure of that. And when my time comes, I will be no more. You can underline that and put it on your refrigerator. Who granted me a reprieve from fear? How will I ever escape? My demise is inevitable. Why is my mind so composed? You see, he's trying to get you, again, the stick up the rear end to get going on these kind of practices of purifying your bad deeds, because death could come at any time. What of value remains with me from my past, now gone forever? These things so engrossed me that I ignored the advice of my gurus. I got diverted in life. And then it's all passing, it all goes away, you know, not there anymore, and I didn't do what I was supposed to do. Leaving behind this world of the living with its relatives and acquaintances, I will go on to wherever I'm going alone. What will all these friends and enemies be to me then? And so, I should be thinking only this night and day, how can I escape from the suffering caused by bad deeds?
Whatever bad deeds I, a simple fool, have collected, whether they be misdeeds by their very nature or bad deeds that come from breaking vows. This is a distinction in the Buddhist text between bad deeds that we kind of all do or are all kind of inclined to do, killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, the four of speech and the three of mind, the usual suspects. And then there are the bad deeds that we do by taking vows not to do bad deeds and breaking them, breaking the vows. There are two different kinds of bad deeds that are mentioned here. I confess them all, standing here before the protectors. Fearful of suffering, with folded hands, I make prostrations over and over again. May the guides take away my transgression, together with my inclination to transgress. Lords, I will not do that again, I will not do that which is not good again. All right, so I think, I don't know what happened. I didn't get all four forces, did I? I think I somehow skipped one. But I'll make it up to you. I'll tell you where they all are, okay? The four forces of this, so just as a summary. Refuge. What will help? Go for refuge. Actually, it's not in that order, is it?
Regret.
Regret. Refuge. Then the third one is the antidote. And the fourth one is restraint. What's called restraint. So if you look at your exercise for class one, the exercise is to do some version of these four forces on your three biggest misdeeds in life for the next week. Okay? So you can, misdeed number one, misdeed number two, misdeed number three, you can fill out like at the break. Okay? And then you can start the four forces, tonight or tomorrow at the latest. Okay? Every day, to do four forces on each one of these. So you'll be actually doing 12 forces total. Each day. Well, same four. And you don't know. And then look, in the second paragraph, I told you which verses deal with the four forces. So the destruction force is dealt with in verses 28 through 46 in the second chapter. Foundation or refuge, 47 to 53. Antidote, 54 to 59. And restraint. Restraint means not going to do it again. I'm going to try not to do it again. 60 through 65. The antidote maybe is the one that I need to just say a minute or two on, for those of you who don't know this teaching. Antidote means, what can I do positively that would balance out the negative thing that I'm, trying to cleanse here? So, for example, here's my confession. I've confessed this before in public. I keep confessing it in the hopes that I don't have to confess it anymore someday. But when I was a teenager, I used to steal from the lockers of my classmates. When they were all out playing sports, me and my friend would like go and loot their lockers and take money out of their wallets because they had changed into their soccer clothes. And I've had financial difficulties in life. In the past, so maybe there's a connection, and so if you're dealing with something like that, stealing, taking what doesn't belong to you, then exercise some kind of charity, some kind of generosity, as a restitution, you see, as a balance for the taking away of other people's stuff. If you're dealing with hurting other people in any other way, do something beneficial for other people, as a positive act that you dedicate to the cleaning of the karma. You understand the principle? Yeah. And if you do these four forces on any karma, no matter how heinous it is, it can be eliminated. It may very well take more than a week. Exercise one is just a week. But maybe just to kind of get you going, like a snowball that rolls down the hill. Because if you really want to get these things off your conscience, it can take a lot longer than a week until you really feel like it's done now, okay? So I often, in my teaching on the four forces, include a fifth force that I kind of like invented, but I think it's important. So you do these four forces and you do them for as long as you feel necessary to do. You are your only judge on that. No one else can say how long it's going to take. But until you feel clean of this, and then you do the fifth force, which is to say, you know, Mr. Karma, who is you, inside of you, I've done these four forces for X number of days, I've done this as, you know, as acts of restitution, you know, and now we're done. And I am clean. And you give yourself absolution, like the Catholic priests do, right? They absolve you of your sin. Only you can absolve you of your karma. Only you. And only you know when that's going to happen. Only you. So that's exercise number one on the basis of the second chapter, mostly, of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. When we meet again at 4:30, nice long break, so relax, chill out, enjoy the California sun. It's always sunny in Southern California. And then at 4:30 we'll hit chapter 3. We'll do chapter 3 in the next session. Thank you.